We're going to revisit this, the subject of gay marriage here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Jennifer Roback Morse will be our guest from the Hoover Institute. She has an interesting take on this, not so much one way or the other, because I think we know where she stands on that. The take she has on this is analyzing the claims that seem to be pretty well established in our public discourse now that marriage is something of a social contract, and that if the state's really going to be neutral on the issue of marriage, the state would take the neutral position, which neither favors nor discriminates against any kind of marriage, be it heterosexual or homosexual marriage. We're going to examine those claims with Jennifer Roback Morse here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. I encourage you to listen and to stay tuned. This will be very interesting stuff. When we conclude our conversation with Jennifer, we're going to be talking with Amy White. She has written a column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Welcome Home, Reagan. We'll get a bit of a tribute to Ronald Reagan in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch with Amy White. And then, to round off the third hour of Issues Etc. today, we're going to be talking with David Van Bima of Time Magazine. He's a senior writer there, about this week's Time Magazine cover story, Faith, God, and the Oval Office. That's the first hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. You can feel free to join us during this first hour and in the second hour, which is open lines for your questions and your comments at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. During open lines, Rush Limbaugh often begins a day's broadcast or an hour's broadcast by saying something like that he is your guiding light through times of trouble and tumult and confusion. Rush Limbaugh is now going on his third divorce. You've read the news, probably. We're going to be talking about not the message, but the messenger. Has the messenger lost his moral authority on his third divorce? We'll be talking about that. Does he have moral authority to speak on issues like gay marriage, where in order to speak against gay marriage, you need to speak in favor of traditional marriage when you're on your third divorce? That's an open lines question. I told you about it yesterday, asked you to give it some thought last night. I'd like your thoughts and your comments on it during the second hour of Issues Etc. Open lines for your questions and your comments. Then during the third hour, Dr. Ben Witherington joins us to talk about the Gnostic Gospels from Asbury Theological Seminary. Jennifer Roback Morse is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. She's a research fellow for the Hoover Institute. She's author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. And she has also written a recent column for National Review Online titled Is Gay Marriage Neutral? Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let's answer the question right off the bat. Is a policy that would favor neither heterosexual marriage nor gay marriage, but permit both as on equal standing, is it neutral on the state part, on the state's part?
This is the big myth. It is absolutely not neutral. And the reason it's not neutral is because there's a whole set of assumptions about what marriage really is, about what human sexuality is really all about, and what the meaning of family and marriage ultimately is. There's a set of assumptions embedded in the position which says that the state ought to be neutral as between gay marriage and heterosexual marriage. And what I do in that article that you mentioned is to go through and try to spell out what some of those assumptions are, and it's most decidedly not a neutral position. The claim is that marriage is essentially a contract that people enter into voluntarily as long as people feel like they are in love, then that's the purpose of the marriage, is to join two people who feel themselves to be in love. And I say that both of those claims are completely false. Marriage is fundamentally not a contract, and the way you feel about your spouse is not the fundamental issue about whether you should get married or not. So those are not the defining qualities of marriage. And by saying that the state should recognize gay marriage as being the same as heterosexual marriage, they're embodying into the law those kinds of presumptions, and those are really not accurate. And therefore, it's not fair to say at all that this is a move toward neutrality among forms of marriage or neutrality between types of citizens.
Before we go on to examine those two claims and give you an opportunity to refute those assumptions behind this notion that the state's move toward gay marriage is a move toward neutrality, why does this claim that it is a move toward neutrality, Why does that have appeal in our society?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. It's a very interesting question. It appeals to us for a couple of reasons. First of all, Americans are very egalitarian people. We don't like to be excluding people. We like a nice level playing field for everybody. So if you can cast an issue in terms of fairness or equality or neutrality, government neutrality, that's very powerful and resonates very strongly with the American people. We also have a tendency to view freedom in terms of government leaving us alone. And so if government puts its big fat thumb on the scale of something or other, we think that's an infringement of our freedom, and that gets us very upset. So casting the issue in these terms is a way of predisposing people to be accepting of gay marriage. Even people who would otherwise be kind of scratching their heads and wondering what this is all about and be kind of reluctant ordinarily, this is a way of casting the issue so that people are more receptive to it.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. The reason I ask is because I have heard well-intentioned opponents of gay marriage say, look, the state has got to be neutral here.
That's right.
And I've thought to myself, are they going to argue for or against gay marriage?
Yeah,
they argue against gay marriage. Now, how could, if the move toward gay marriage is not neutral, are you saying that no neutrality is possible
That's
or
exactly
advisable?
Right. That's right. It's not possible to be neutral on a question of this kind. You can be neutral on the question on things that have to do with consumption and consumer goods and things like that. If you want to buy red curtains, if you want to buy blue curtains, if you want to buy a Dodge, if you want to buy a Chevy, the state should be neutral about those kinds of things. That's perfectly acceptable and understandable. But when you're talking about the premise of how we actually do the business itself and what the purpose of, for example, the purpose of the economy or the purpose of marriage, you can't be neutral about competing claims about what the purpose of marriage is or competing claims about what the purpose of the economy is as far as that's concerned. So when you're having an argument about, gee, what is marriage all about, there are competing claims, and they're truth claims. They're not claims about preference that have to do, well, gee, I prefer a male partner and you prefer a female partner. That's not fundamentally what the issue is all about. The issue fundamentally is, what does this institution mean? And whether you prefer a certain kind of partner or not, that's not really the issue. The issue is, what does it mean to say that you're going to get married to your sex partner versus doing something else with your sex partner? Or what does it mean to say that the state recognizes certain kind of unions and places them in a different category from other kinds of unions? There are a set of empirical claims that are behind that, and somebody's right and somebody's wrong about what marriage really is all about. And that, it seems to me, is where we need to be having the discussion. We do not need a nationwide referendum on whether we like gay people or not. That's pointless, you know. And if that's what it was all about, then it would be true to say opponents of gay marriage are meanies, you know, they're just out to be mean to gay people. But that's not what the issue is. The issue is, what is the meaning of human sexuality and what is the meaning of marriage? And that's what we need to be talking about.
So it makes as little sense to argue that the state can be neutral with regard to the marriage issue as it does to say the state can be neutral with regard to murder or how you drive your car on the road or something like that.
Well, a better analogy that might resonate with some of your listeners would be that the state should be neutral between capitalism and socialism. See, that simply makes no sense when you think about it. The argument over whether you should have capitalism or socialism or something in between is not an argument about, let's be fair to all those people who walk around town passing out the daily worker. You know, it's not about fairness. It's about, how does the economy work in fact? And that's where the argument needs to be. And if you turn the argument into an argument about fairness and say, well, we have to accommodate the socialists and their views because it would be unfair to exclude them, you're going to end up, that's going to bias the whole discussion in favor of a market that has lots of government intervention in it. That's not a neutral position at all, and I think everybody would recognize that it's not a neutral position. But that's what we're kind of doing when we're saying, oh, gee, we need to be neutral as between people who are making different kinds of truth claims about what marriage is really all about. And that you really can't accommodate differing views of what marriage is, in fact. Marriage either is a contract or it is a lifelong gift of self. And if it's a contract, then sure, open it up to gay people and groups of three or four or more. But if it's not a contract, if it's the lifelong gift of self, then you have to talk about what it means to do that sensibly and what kinds of institutions need to surround it in order to support it and sustain it in the society.
We're talking with Jennifer Roback Morse, research fellow of the Hoover Institute about gay marriage. Jennifer, I think I've heard the term social contract in the last year more than I have ever, applied on both sides of this issue to marriage. So as you're swimming upstream here vigorously, make the case that marriage is not a social contract.
Well, marriage is not a social contract. It's not a private contract as far as that's concerned. Now, you've talked to me many times about my book, Love and Economics. In that book, I have a whole chapter called Why Marriage is Not a Contract, Why the Family is Not a Contract. The reason it's not a contract is that contracts have to do with specifying rights and responsibilities of very well-defined parties towards one another over a very well-defined, well-specified period of time. And if you enter into your marriage with that kind of an attitude, you will unplug your whole marriage. You will destroy your marriage. Because marriage has to do with generosity and has to do with openness to the unknown and the unforeseen. And the typical contract does not do that. The contract says you will deliver a truckload of cement to this address on this date and I will pay you this number of dollars. And when that delivery has taken place, the contract is over. What you're talking about in married life is something much more contingent, much more spontaneous, and something that requires much more trust than the average contract. And when married couples start talking and thinking in terms of the contractual mentality, what they're really doing is saying, what's in it for me, rather than saying, how can I help? How can I contribute to the, quote, common good of our little household here? You see, the household is a place where it really makes sense to talk about the common good and the social good and so on, because you do have something that the family is creating for itself. The couple is creating something, and they both have to contribute, and they contribute in an ongoing, open-ended kind of a way. And the contractual mentality is quite destructive of that. And I think the reason we make this mistake is that we have a tendency to think that all voluntary private agreements with cooperation in them, that those are contracts. We use the contract metaphor to describe all kinds of voluntary means of cooperation. And that's a big mistake. There are a lot of forms of cooperation that have nothing to do with contracts, either narrowly understood or even broadly understood. And so we need to kind of open our minds to that fact, that cooperation is not the one and only way of cooperating is to write a contract. There are lots of forms of cooperation, and marriage is, in a sense, a much more basic form of cooperation than even a contract, which we economists like to talk about so much.
I'm thinking about the typical marriage vows, some of them for what they're worth. But usually they recognize what you have called there, that ongoing and open-ended of this vow. And that is, you know, it's kind of a come what may, good or bad, sickness or health.
That's right.
You name it, for life, here we are together.
That's
we
right.
don't know what's going to happen, and we can't foresee what's going to happen. But we know that we will continue to give, as you say, selflessly to one another throughout all of it.
That's right. And you see, the contractual mentality is to protect yourself against somebody trying to take advantage of you, you see. And there's without denying that married couples do sometimes abuse one another, without denying that, you don't want to enter into it with the idea of, this is a guy that I have to watch out for every minute or he's going to try to take me for all I'm worth. You know, that's not how you want to enter into your married life, Todd, you know. And if you do, you're setting yourself up for failure from the very beginning. So that's another reason that you just do not want to pursue this contractual mentality. And as I said in the article, the fact is that the idea that marriage is a contract, that is an idea which has failed spectacularly for straight couples. Why in the world should we take an error of that magnitude and institutionalize it in the legal structure of our society by saying implicitly that we recognize marriage as a contract, so that any two consenting parties, or even any three or any four, any consenting parties can create a marriage for themselves. If we institutionalize, that's institutionalizing an idea which has, in a dramatic way, failed for straight people.
So if it is not a social contract, and it is harmful both to individual marriages and to society to think of marriage as a social contract, How would we rightly understand marriage? How would you summarize it?
Well, marriage is the lifelong gift of self between one man and one woman. And I think I was very interested that you mentioned Rush Limbaugh and his three divorces in the intro to this program, because I think we've put ourselves on very, very faulty ground by accepting the divorce revolution so casually, you know, that what he's doing, in effect, is treating those women as if they were consumer goods. You see, this is the problem with the whole mentality. I'm not happy with you anymore, so I trade you in on a new model, you know. Nobody wants to be on the receiving end of that kind of mentality. But we basically talked ourselves into it by saying, I reserve the right to treat you as an object, and therefore I will permit you to treat me as an object. And, hey, the alternative is I'm going to do all I can for you, and you're going to do all you can for me. And I accept that there are going to be days when you're going to fuss, and there are going to be days when I'm going to fuss. And I'm not going to enjoy you every minute of the next 50 years of my life, but we're going to be there for one another. And it seems to me that if you take the long-term perspective, that is a way of life that is much more life-giving and much more satisfactory to larger numbers of people.
Now, I have to ask at this point, I think I can probably infer what you would think about a prenuptial agreement between prospective husbands and wives.
Well, I think they're saying up front, in advance, I don't trust you. You know, the only case where I could see where that could be legitimate or non-harmful would be an older couple getting married after they've already raised their kids, they're widowed, or they've been widowed, and they have assets from the previous marriage, and they need to make it clear to all of them whose assets, where those assets are going to be if one of them dies. And the reason I think that could be legitimate is, first of all, there's a deceased party there, not a discarded party, right, the person who's died. And the children of both of those two prior marriages, those children are not the common good of these two particular people. So they need to make it clear, you know, what they're actually agreeing to. In that case, I think it could make some sense. But if you're talking about a couple of 25-year-olds or 30-year-olds getting married for the first time, no previous children from previous marriages or anything like that, I think the idea of getting a prenuptial agreement under those circumstances is a signal that I don't really trust you, and you can't really trust me. So this is a business deal, and this is not a sacramental, lifelong gift of self.
Jennifer, before we let you go, I'd like you to tell our listeners about your new website, jointhemarriagerevolution.com.
Yes, I've just started a new website. It's very much under construction, but that's okay. People can go and check it out and let me know what they think of it. I'm trying to put up there links to things that I think are interesting and helpful, ways of for people to contact me, to either buy my books or to bring me out for seminars and speeches and things like that, which I like to do, or book me for radio shows like this one, and to just give feedback about the various programs that I've done. So it's, as you said, it's jointhemarriagerevolution.com. There's material on that site that you can't get anywhere else on the Internet because I've put up my print articles there that don't have Internet links. And I hope people will drop in from time to time and see what's going on.
Jennifer, we are always happy to book you as a guest. It's always our pleasure to speak with you. And thank you. Keep up the good work.
Thanks very much.
Jennifer Roback Morris is a research fellow for the Hoover Institute. I do encourage you folks, when you get home tonight, you go online, check your email, just grab your browser and go to jointhemarriagerevolution.com. It's all one long word, jointhemarriagerevolution.com, and find out what Jennifer has in store for you there. She's author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work, and she's also written a recent column for National Review Online titled, Is Gay Marriage Neutral? Amy White joins us. You may have read her column here just today in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch for the last few minutes of this segment and then into the next. Amy, of course, is a mother of two in Oakville, a corporate and political speechwriter and author of this column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch as a tribute to Ronald Reagan. Welcome home, Reagan. Amy, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks, Todd, very much.
Everyone's been watching this, whether they wanted to or not.
That's absolutely right.
What's been going on over the course of the last week? I understand that still today and then probably for the weeks ahead, people are still making what the press is calling pilgrimages to Simi Valley, to the Reagan Library, to the crypt there where he has been interred. Why the outpouring for this president?
Well, I think there's a lot of different reasons. I think there's people who, from the time that Ronald Reagan came on the national scene, recognized him as a particular gift to America at that time, both because he was willing to talk about politics and world policy from a moral framework, and also because he was essentially American. I think in the things that he did in his lifetime, the rural roots that he had a true love for America, and I think that most Americans saw that and responded to it instinctively. Now, of course, we have a generation of children who did not even really experience his presidency, who are now being brought to these sites, and, you know, parents are saying to kids, hey, this was a great, great American.
My daughter, 12 years old, asked me, she said something about what we're going to watch on television. I said, it's not going to be on. She said, is that because that dude died? Yes, President Reagan. He passed away. What's the big deal, she said. And we were about 5 minutes away from home. And I said, honey, it would just take too long to explain it to you, mm-hmm. what the big deal is. Do you think that Americans' thoughts about Reagan mellowed a bit, sweetened, since he left office prior to his death, some time afterwards, from Alzheimer's?
Well, I think there's several different things that took place. I think that while his presidency was actually unfolding, there was such heavy criticism of just about everything he did from certain quarters. And when he stood in front of the Berlin Wall and said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, there may have been some conservatives or some Christian or some like-minded people who cheered. Certainly all those who were gathered there in Berlin cheered. But back home, the reaction of the press was absolutely condemning. How can you say this? You're nothing but a cowboy. You've offended our allies. You've offended our enemies. You're setting us up for nuclear holocaust. I mean, when you look at the press clippings following that speech, you can see that nearly every major journalist in the United States got it wrong. They did not see that what Ronald Reagan had done was set in process a motion that was literally going to help bring to a conclusion the communist empire. And one of Reagan's main concerns with communism was not just that they didn't believe in personal property for all or the rights of individuals, but that it was godless. And for someone who was raised by a fundamentalist Christian mother who himself professed to have a personal relationship with Christ, this was clearly an evil that had to be battled. So I think America, in terms of the intellectual leadership in America, the people who decide what runs on the news programs at night, the people who write columns, they thought he was a disaster. And every year that's gone by since his presidency has further solidified that he not only finished off the Cold War, he did so decisively and left no remains. And so I think that that has had an effect. And then you also have people who didn't think much of Reagan in office who were so awestruck by the faithfulness and the love he showed when he got his diagnosis of Alzheimer's. And the farewell note that he wrote to the United States really showed such a depth of faith in God, faith in America, and just personal character that even those who disliked him, even those perhaps who hated him, had to stop and say, this is an exceptional man.
Amy White is our guest. We're talking about Ronald Reagan. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Let's face it, most Christians just don't know what to do with the Old Testament book of Leviticus. Does it still apply today? If so, how? How are we to rightly understand the Old Testament law, ceremonial, civil, and moral? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for June is the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus. For more information on this book, visit our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues, Etc. book of the month for June, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus. Or order it by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. The Supreme Court dodged the Under God controversy by ruling that the divorced California atheist who sued on behalf of his daughter didn't have legal standing to bring the case. It's likely that the issue will come back to the court. Ironically, the court's decision came on the 50th anniversary of Congress including Under God in the pledge. David Garrow, a court historian, said, "The court has been uneven on church and state issues." That's correct. Church-state issues were relatively rare until the 1940s, but since then there have been numerous cases with inconsistent conclusions. Those decisions have come down on both sides of the issue. Political scientist Kenneth Wald notes that from 1953 to 1969, the average Supreme Court justice cast a vote to strictly separate church and state in two-thirds of the cases with church-state issues. Since 1986, that average has dropped to 45%. Will the shift continue? If you believe that righteousness exalts a nation, one question to consider is this: does the healthy progress of religion happen more, A, when we await court decisions, or B, when you and I act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with God today? I'm Dale Meyer.
Danger and pain in a war-torn area also means opportunities for sharing Christ. This Global Minute urges you to pray for Christians who are actively helping others in Iraq. Operation Mobilization reports that men and women in an affiliated ministry have been involved in Iraq meeting some of the needs. They helped in medical clinics and schools and have helped with clean water projects. Operation Mobilization missionaries offer help around the globe, working within the local culture to introduce Christ's love. All kinds of skills can be put to use. Pray that political barriers and cultural barriers won't prevent Christians in Iraq from sharing God's love with Muslims who are seeking help and answers. Take a step toward missions by visiting Operation Mobilization on the Internet at www.usa.om.org. That's usa.om.org.
Seminar speaker and pastor Dr. John Maxwell on Sermons in the Home.
Lessons I've learned from my dad.
Classic parenting skills.
He's the greatest preacher I've ever heard. He's the godliest man that I know. He's the best leader that I've ever followed. He truly is my hero.
On the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Amy White is our guest. In about 10 minutes, David Van Bema joins us from Time Magazine. We'll talk about this week's Time Magazine cover story, Faith, God, and the Oval Office. Until then, Amy White is our guest, a corporate and political speechwriter. She's written a column, as a regular column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the latest, Welcoming Home Reagan. Amy, let's talk about, and since you are a political speechwriter, we must discuss him as the great communicator. First of all, he would have said it was the ideas he communicated rather than his ability to communicate that were great. But how much did his speechwriters have to do with his reputation for being a great communicator?
Well, President Reagan was provided with some of the best speechwriters of our time, and the person, the only woman who served, or actually the second woman who served as a speechwriter in the White House for Reagan was Peggy Noonan. And she is the one who actually scripted some of his more memorable speeches that we were still talking about just over the past 2 weeks, remembering President Reagan. So speechwriters really have a great deal to do with it, except as a speechwriter, I can tell you, Todd, that you can write a beautiful manuscript that in the wrong hands just absolutely falls flat.
In that connection, I love George W. Bush. I think he's a great guy. But sometimes I wonder, he could have the best speechwriters in the world, but his ability to communicate in the same kind of just absolutely fine semi-satin gloss that Reagan did just isn't there. He is a little more folksy, to put it plainly. Do you agree?
Yeah, he is. And, you know, Reagan had the opportunity, by God's providence, to be trained through most of his life for the role of president from a verbal perspective. He began his career in radio. He had to talk his way into college with no money. He had to talk his way into a scholarship, walked into the president of Eureka College's office and asked for an athletic scholarship and promised to wash dishes for 4 years. And the guy was a professional at talking himself into good situations. So he had radio. He had the career in Hollywood, followed by being the spokesman for General Electric on TV. So really you can see Providence's hand in him really being able to hone those skills before he reached the office of president.
You mentioned Peggy Noonan as one of Reagan's chief speechwriters. What made her and makes her a great speechwriter?
Well, Peggy Noonan has a real commitment to doing a lot of reading of great classics. So she's extremely well-versed in poetry and different prose by the masters, literary prose. We're not talking about newspaper columns, goodness knows, but the 18th, 19th century prose that was so lovely. She also is a student of presidential rhetoric, and when she was a speechwriter in the White House, one thing she would do if she wasn't working on a speech is she would sit in a big chair and she would read through all the historical records of speeches of presidents who had gone before. So she had a real sense for the rhythms of that office after studying it from a historical perspective. And when she spent that time with the poetry, I think that gives a natural cadence to her writing that combined with Reagan and his ability to deliver just made magic.
Finally, and we only have about a minute and a half here for this final question, the appeal of Ronald Reagan to young people. I was one of them. Early college, late high school, to whom his message and his appeal was very strong. What was it, Amy?
I think that he reminded us of America that existed before the missteps of Vietnam, before the mistakes and the disappointment of Watergate. His own personal lifespan transcended that period in our history. For people of a particular age group, they went through school being taught by people who were made significantly disillusioned with the promise of America. The 60s were a turbulent time of a lot of rebellion. We turned our back on a lot of things we considered to be essential American, embraced a different path. Ronald Reagan came along as really sort of your perpetual grandfather and said, ah, no, I've been here since the Depression. I've seen Pearl Harbor. I got through World War II. This is just a bump in the road, and let me remind you what makes this country great. And I think that for the young generation, we stood up and we recognized that as truth and reached out, grabbed a hold of it, and really never forgot.
You can read Amy White's column, Welcoming Home Reagan, in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch and on the web at stltoday.com. Amy White, thank you for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Amy White is a mother of two in Oakville, a corporate and political speechwriter and author of this column, Welcoming Home Reagan, in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. In a few minutes, we're going to be hearing from David Van Beem. I had an opportunity to speak with him a little bit earlier today. And you may have seen the cover story in Time magazine, Faith, God, and the Oval Office. He had a hand in putting that cover story together, talking about the religion gap, as it has come to be called. I started our conversation with David, senior writer for Time magazine. I started our conversation with him by asking him about that religion gap and what it looks like. How important is the religion gap here in American politics? How important is it going to be for the presidential election? I began by asking him about the religion gap and what it looks like in presidential politics.
Well, what it really is a polarization along the lines of how often people go to church or how religious they self-identify as. People in the poll that we took, people who identified as very religious and went to church weekly or more tended to be Republicans, and people who went to church or synagogue less frequently were more likely to be Democrats. And that it was a fairly strong dichotomy, and I think that we're seeing it played out in the campaign.
How important is it to the American public, as far as we can tell, that their president be a religious person?
Well, it's always been important to the American public that the president be or seem to be religious, because I think it's always been important to the public that the president seem not to be so full of himself that he wouldn't acknowledge that there might be a greater authority. But what's different, and they want a president who's able to believe in something, I think, is kind of a safe way to put it. But what's different maybe this time around, and was to some extent in the last presidential election, is that the Republican Party is so heavily based in evangelical voters that that's not really enough, and that the president, who is himself born again, really has to talk the talk and walk the walk much more than some previous candidates have. And it puts that, plus his own religious inclination, sort of puts us in a much more hotter zone than we would normally be in a presidential election.
With the recent passing of President Ronald Reagan, how has that changed the context of this conversation, especially given the fact, and this is quoted late in the story in Time magazine, Ron Reagan Jr., in one of his eulogies for his father this last week, said that he was a deeply religious man. He never made the fatal mistake, as so many politicians have, of wearing his faith on his sleeve to gain political advantage. How has that changed the conversation so far?
Well, I think that Reagan, I think that Ronald Reagan had in some ways the opportunity not to wear it on a sleeve. At the time when he was, he managed to pick up a lot of evangelical votes without necessarily constantly going back and doing what they wanted him to do. It wasn't quite lip service, but he wasn't. The evangelical political community was not as assertive then as it is now, and not as demanding. And so, although Ron Reagan's comment does suggest the way that a lot of more moderate Christians might feel about a president or a presidential candidate, Bush, as I say, has to respond to a base that's made up of quite conservative believing Christians, for whom, for instance, it's not really totally enough to say that he's in favor of a constitutional amendment that marriage is about a man and a woman. He really kind of has to go back to them and say it again and again, and this puts him in a little bit of a bind. He hasn't really done that yet. He's sort of said it once or twice publicly, and not stressed it that much again. And whether that will be sufficient to get him all the evangelical votes that he wants, or to prevent 4 million evangelicals from sitting on their hands, which is what his strategist Karl Rove feels happened in the last election, is a good question.
Monday this week, he addressed via satellite the annual convention of the Southern Baptist Convention, 8,000 strong there, but representing 6.3 million Southern Baptists in the United States. And he talked about gay marriage. He talked about a marriage amendment. Is that an example of the kind of going back to his base that he needs to do?
Yeah, he needs to do that probably repeatedly. And the problem with communications these days is that it's very difficult to narrowcast. So if you do that enough, I mean, it's not like the Baptists are a small audience, but if you do that to the group that you hope will hear you on the topic, you will inevitably see it in the headlines the next day. And the flip side to trying to gain those 4 million capturable evangelical votes is that there are a certain number of votes by more moderate believers and non-believers and so on, although I suppose that the swing votes are more moderate believers for the most part, that he risks losing if he sounds too much as though he's making policy out of scripture.
Where do African-American voters fit into the mix here when we look at the religion gap and in particular the president's appeal to his base?
African-Americans are sort of an anomaly in what I've been talking about. Whereas almost everybody else sort of divides with the more frequent churchgoers and self-identified very religious people on the Republican side and the other folks on the Democratic side. African Americans who define as very religious and frequent churchgoers still often vote Democratic. So they are in some ways an exception to what we've been talking about.
And then Roman Catholic voters as well. I know you've been paying quite a bit of attention to that with regard to the abortion issue, but more generally with regard to the religion gap, where do they figure in?
Well, Roman Catholic voters are a very good example of what we're talking about, because there was a time 30 or so years ago when 80% of Roman Catholics voted Democratic. And you could say, sort of, you know, I mean, with 80% assurance, that if somebody was a Catholic, then he or she was likely to vote Democratic. Now you can't say that. You can say that if somebody is a frequent, you know, a weekly mass attendee and defines him or herself as very religious, that he or she is very likely to be Republican. And if not, then he or she is very likely to be Democratic. And the Catholics are split almost down the middle. So what used to be sort of a unified denominational allegiance or connection to one party is now much more of a split between the very religious and I don't want to say not religious, you know, when I talk about the other folks. There are some indications that people who really define themselves as you know, as fairly religious and who go to church like a couple of times a month are much more likely to not identify with Republicans. So I'm not trying to say that it's the pious on one side and the godless on the other, but merely that when you get into the verys, you can start making generalizations.
David Van Bima is our guest. He is a senior writer for Time magazine. He also did the reporting for the Time magazine cover story titled Faith, God, and the Oval Office, joining us from New York. David, one of the most, at least to me, telling comparisons that's put forth in the Time magazine piece, one of the bar graphs side by side in answer to two questions respectively, would you describe President George W. Bush as a man of strong religious faith? Would you describe Senator John Kerry as a man of strong religious faith? It's a very telling difference there. George Bush's bar graph is pretty high up there. Senator Kerry's are all pretty low in all categories. What does that tell you?
Well, that tells me that that George Bush has been very out front in talking about his faith, and that Kerry has been, while describing himself as a Catholic whose Catholicism means a tremendous amount to him and has meant a tremendous amount to him, has not, you know, put it quite as front and center. It might also sort of flow into the question of Kerry's stance, his pro-choice, consistent pro-choice voting on abortion. That might be affecting people's responses to the poll as well.
You wrote a sidebar on that very subject. Has that worked for or against Kerry in the presidential race when it comes to this issue of religion?
Well, I can't tell you about how abortion, I don't have in front of me abortion figures, straight up abortion figures, which is kind of the question that you're asking. But what we did poll was on the position of a handful of bishops, about five bishops, who said that they would deny communion to either Carrier or politicians in general who were consistent pro-choice voters. And what our polls indicate is that position of denial of communion is not popular either with those Catholics polled in general or even with the Catholics who describe themselves as being very religious, that majorities of both groups, smaller majorities in the latter case, but nonetheless majorities, did not support that small group of bishops in that, which would tend to suggest that this latest controversy around the issue is not one that's going to have really high negatives for Kerry.
Should abortion be considered, generally speaking, in the American voter ranks, should it be considered, according to what we can tell the voters are thinking, an overriding issue for them?
I'm not certain that I can answer the question of whether abortion should be considered an overriding issue for voters. Are you talking about Catholics?
Well, no, what I'm asking is, if you look at the numbers of how people vote on the issues, is abortion an overriding issue for those voters?
I think that for most voters, and here I must admit, and that if there was a bar graph that I missed it. But I'm not certain that abortion is an overriding issue for most American voters. What I can talk more specifically to is whether it is an overriding issue for the Catholic Church.
And what
that
do you
I
find,
can speak to.
What do you know there?
Well, the Catholic Church, I mean, there's a lot of folks, especially Democrats in the last month or so, since this communion, the so-called wafer watch began, have said, well, why are the bishops paying so much attention to the politicians' records on abortion, to the seeming exclusion or overshadowing of their positions on other issues which are important to the Catholic Church, a very good example being capital punishment, which is obviously also a life and death issue. The Pope, the Church is opposed to capital punishment. The Pope has gone to great lengths in the last decade or so to suggest that capital punishment is part of what he calls the culture of death, along with abortion and euthanasia and some other things. And so the question is, well, is abortion really, by Catholic teaching, you know, an overriding issue? And the answer is, well, yeah, sort of, it is. I mean, overriding may be a little bit too strong, but if you were to compare it with capital punishment, for instance, you would see that there is a penalty in canon law for abortion, and it is excommunication. It doesn't get you don't see many people being excommunicated, but it's on the books. There's no penalty for participating in a state-sanctioned execution. The teaching on abortion is described as definitive, which means that as an article of faith, you have to go along with it. The teaching on capital punishment is described as authentic, which means that you can apply reason to whether or not you're going to go along with it. So in kind of a measurable, legalistic sort of way, abortion really is more important. What is not the case, what doesn't follow from that, is that a believer is required to act politically in a certain way. The Church, although some of the bishops have been suggesting that may be the case, but it is not nearly as written into Church teaching as what I've just been discussing. The Church leaves room for what's called prudence on the part of the believer in terms of his or her political behavior in support of these sorts of teachings. The assumption is that the believer is still going to be opposed to abortion, which may or may not be true in the case of, you know, many American Catholics, but that's what the Church says, that if you want to be a true believer, then this is what you got to believe. And But in terms of what do I do with that in order to create a society where there's less abortion, there's more latitude. So, for instance, a good Catholic like Rick Santorum, who's a quite conservative Catholic senator, might support the reelection, which he did indeed, of Arlen Specter, who is a pro-choice Republican, a pro-choice Republican senator. Because if you maintain your majority in the Senate, the Republican majority, the Republicans skew pro-life, and the Democrats skew more pro-choice. So what you're doing is you're saying, well, I'm gonna support this pro-choice guy in the interest of that abortion will eventually be decreased. And another argument along the same lines is which Mario Cuomo famously made in the 1980s was, I'm against abortion, but I'm going to vote pro-choice because I think that overturning Roe versus Wade would merely push abortion underground. It would not decrease it. It might possibly make it more dangerous. Therefore, the sin is compounded. So that's where the notion of prudence comes in. There's at least according to the teachings of the Church, there's wiggle room there. The Vatican, in a letter that sent out last year, and some of the bishops have sort of been moving in the direction of decreasing the prudential latitude in with regard to how much pro-choice voting they're willing to stand for on the part of Catholic politicians.
With only 1 minute, one final question, David. We talked about how President Bush has used the religion issue to his advantage, perhaps to his disadvantage. How has his competitor, Senator John Kerry, used the religion issue?
Well, I think that Kerry has tried to play it that he's a good Catholic, that he took, if I remember correctly, a rosary with him to Vietnam, that it's something that that he comes back to again and again as kind of a touchstone, that he went to the Holy Land and went to Capernaum where Jesus did some of his miracles, that it's very, very important to him, while at the same time trying to be reticent enough, and indeed he may well personally be reticent enough to not give the impression that he's going to let either the Catholic hierarchy or Scripture dictate policy in the event he has a chance to make it.
David Van Bima, thank you for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was David Van Bima, senior writer for Time magazine. He did the reporting for the Time magazine cover story. You probably have seen it, Faith, God, and the Oval Office, and he joined us from New York. Now, if you'd like to respond to that interview, give us a call in the next hour for open lines. We're going to be talking a bit about Rush Limbaugh's divorce. Now, this isn't his first. This isn't his second. This is his third. He's been married for the third time and now will be divorced for the third time. My questions for you on this. First of all, does this... Now, we're talking not about the message, but the messenger. We're not going to dismiss Rush's arguments because of his divorce. That would be illegitimate. What about his personal moral authority to speak on issues like gay marriage? In order to speak against gay marriage, you need to speak in favor of traditional marriage. Well, he is about ready to dissolve his third traditional marriage. Has this silenced him, as you have listened to Rush Limbaugh of late, has this silenced him on these moral issues to which he could be speaking but isn't? Have you heard him talk about it on the air? I've listened for as much as I can a day, but that's not very much, being a Rush Limbaugh fan. Have you heard him discuss his divorce on the air, or have you heard his listeners bring it up? I mean, they're talking about everything. Should he, what would you think if he remarried for a fourth time? Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'd like your thoughts on Rush Limbaugh's third divorce when we come back. It's dealing with that question about moral authority. Talking about the messenger, not the message. What about something brought up by Jennifer Roback Morse in the first 25 minutes of the program when she heard us promo this next hour of Open Lines on the Rush Limbaugh divorce question? And she said it goes to how he treats women. Think about it. Give us a call during this break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.